This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Writer Patricia Lockwood grew up in a Catholic family, but hers was a little different than most others. Her dad was a priest. Not a former priest, but a fully ordained bread and wine, body and blood priest. It's true the Catholic doctrine forbids priests from being married and having families, but there are exceptions. Greg Lockwood was one, and that led to an exceptional upbringing for Patricia. She tells the story in her new memoir, Priest Daddy. It documents how she grappled with faith, family, and the complexities of the Catholic Church. Tricia Lockwood reads this Saturday evening at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, but first joins me on this program. Welcome, Tricia.
Hey.
Well, I guess first you have to answer the big question. How'd your dad, Greg Lockwood, Father Greg, get permission to be a priest and a family man?
Well, the short version is that he sort of started out as like a rock and roll atheist, and then he joined the Navy, and he had a conversion experience on a nuclear submarine, you know, like 100 miles below the surface of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets back on land, and he tells my mother, you know, I'm a Christian now. I'm going to become a Lutheran minister. And he does that. And then after a while, he's like, well, that's not extreme enough. I think I would like to be a Catholic. And so when this took place over a period of years. There's a lot going on here. Yeah.
This is the short version.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's like, well, you know what? I'm going to convert even more than I already did. And then there's a special loophole where when a married minister of another faith converts to Catholicism, you can apply for a dispensation to become a married Catholic priest. And that's what he did.
All right. And the conversion experience was, as you tell it, watching the movie The Exorcist in a submarine.
In the wake of watching The Exorcist 72 times over the course of a single patrol, yes.
Yeah. So that might turn anybody into a Catholic. Who knows?
That's what I said. I was like, why are all these guys not priests? Like, literally every single one of these seamen should be priests.
All right. So now you grow up in this family. He's got an actual parish. He's preaching and teaching and acting as a priest. Near the beginning, you talk about this growing up in a family. Did it feel extraordinary to you growing up in this family?
I think that we were sort of encouraged by my parents to feel special, which is maybe not great, you know, when you think about that particular environment. But yeah, we knew that we were unusual. And we knew largely that my father was the reason that we were so unusual. And it's also true that, you know, in any sort of parish, the priest is like a celebrity. So, I mean, imagine the extent to which we, his special, unusual family, were even more so.
In the process of becoming a priest, you tell this amazing story about the family being involved and having to take the psychopath test.
The psychopath test.
Tell us more.
Well, I honestly don't remember taking it. I know they told me that I took it, and I was like, man, I wish I could remember that psychopath test. But yeah, it was actually it was a personality inventory.
Yeah.
And they administered it to my dad, and he, you know, he torpedoed it on the first try because he got angry at it. And so he tried to fail it on purpose and be known as a psychopath, and then he had to take it again another time. My mom refused to take it because they asked too many questions with double negatives. And then they gave it to the kids, too. But we thankfully or unthankfully don't remember it.
See, to me, the fact that you want to be a priest because you were on a submarine and saw The Exorcist 72 times, I think you failed. I mean, that's just me.
I think you're already a psychopath. You're a psychopath already. Sorry, you get an F.
But they have very strict doctrine. There are rules in the Catholic Church. I know I are one. And so, therefore, you had to have your own test. So you don't remember. Tell us more about your dad's character, because that is also a very big part of your memoir, his own personality. Tell us more about him.
He's sort of a larger-than-life figure. I actually cut a part where I compared him to J. Thaddeus Toad from Wind in the Willows, so kind of a grandiose, manic, grandstanding character. In another review, he was compared to Ignatius J. Riley from Confederacy of Dunces, and that also applies. I think that both of those are good. I think that you can really only find his precedence in literature.
Wow. So, but he's a real guy, and he's acting as a priest. So again, what's it like growing up? You're encouraged to feel somewhat extraordinary, but it did have its difficulties for you as a young woman growing up in that household.
Sure. So the institution, you know, which for someone else is something you walk to every Sunday at noon or whenever, was very much present in our own home. So it's not just that my father was a patriarch. And it's not just that he was a priest. He somehow wove those two things together so that it felt like he was much more of a figure of authority than I think a typical father would be.
godlike, perhaps.
This happens.
This happens in the mind of those who think they're acting as intermediaries. Let's talk about and I think another illustration of his personality might be the hunting trip on which you all took part. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so my dad does get these manias. It's very much like, you know, Toad of Toad Hall with his motor cars. So he'll get very, very excited about something. And he decided for a period in my childhood to get really, really excited about guns and hunting. I mean, it's not something that he was particularly good at. My dad isn't a guy who wants to kill an animal. But he basically, he got this gun collection going, took us to the shooting range all the time, and then took us on a trip to, what do I compare it to in the book? A motel that looked like where Smokey the Bear went to cheat on his wife, which still strikes me as accurate. Yeah. So, you know, we're just hanging out there, and he's got my brother up in a tree stand. He's got my sister in a tree stand, strapped there with a belt for 3 hours. And, you know, they come back when the hunting trip's over, and there's no deer. Nothing has been murdered, but my dad steps forward with his arm around my brother's shoulder, and he's like, well, you know, your brother, he got so excited out there that he went ahead and he crapped his pants. And so literally the only souvenir we had of that trip is just, you know, my brother's pants crapping. We never succeeded in shooting a deer, killing a deer, anything like that.
Your brother.
So he builds things up to a very, very great degree, but then usually things get punctured at a certain point.
Your brother uniquely finds himself in his own waste, but you were in deer waste as well. Deer urine, I think, was part of the camouflage effort, right?
Well, yeah, you have to dab it on all your pulse points or else the deer won't be attracted to you and trot toward you so that you can kill them. That was the idea. Yeah. I mean, this is something that real hunters do. So it's not like it was just my dad's own particular fetish, but it's still weird. Let's be real about it.
Probably it could have been your brother's accident that put them off, though.
It's a very scatological chapter, come to think of it. Like, very
meanwhile, you all go off and have this adventure in the woods because your dad suddenly becomes enamored of guns. Your mom is the only one who bags a deer, but not in the conventional way.
Oh, yeah. She hit that shit with her car. Yeah. She definitely ran over a deer. I mean, it's the sort of thing where my dad thinks that he's good at things, and then it's my mom who ends up being the one who actually is. So that is a prevailing theme of the book, I would say, is my dad is the prideful one, but my mom is the one who sneaks in there and actually gets it done.
But this is where it does take a little bit of a dark turn, because he doesn't really appreciate that. And he shows, I mean, his anger, frankly, when he's upended this way.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who went through his 30s, you know, on the verge of apoplexy, basically. And later on, my mom was like, well, his blood pressure was very high and it was untreated for years. But yeah, he was sort of a guy who would blow up. And then it would all be over very quickly. And then he would wonder, you know, why you were upset about anything he had said. I think that can be typical of angry dads.
What was your relationship with the church early on? It was interesting that you appeared to be pretty pious in your younger days.
Oh, yes. Yes. I was a rule follower and piety was the name of the game for me. But it wasn't. I mean, I think that I had a fairly typical relationship with the church as a child. It wasn't until I was a teenager and got involved in the 90s youth group boom that I became actually what I would consider pious, like in the real sense. I became actually religious at that point, you know.
Tell us the name of your 90s youth group.
Could it be anything other than God's Gang?
There you go.
Because we were very concerned about gangs in the 90s, and we figured that all children were going to join one at some point anyway, so why not let it be a gang for God?
So again, most of this is a little bit lighthearted as we go through, but it does take a bit of a turn here. You became somewhat concerned, or at least knowledgeable, about what was going on in the Catholic Church, overhearing some of what was going on because of the scandals, the sex scandals among priests. Tell us kind of what you knew and how you were feeling about these things as you learned more and more.
This was interesting because the wave of scandals where they were very much in the public eye didn't really break until I was out of the house. And that began with the stuff in Boston. But it was true that growing up in my house, you were always hearing things about certain priests. There was this sort of information that was almost atmospheric where you knew stuff about these guys, or there were suspicions about these people, or certain men had been sent away for therapy, which is what the church did, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. So it was not so much, it's hard to know whether we knew more than other people or whether it was just that our network stretched so far across the United States that we just had more of these anecdotes sort of that we were hearing them around the dinner table than other people. It was almost like shop talk in my house.
What was your reaction to it? I mean, clearly the church was not going public with this. It was not open about it. I mean, I wonder what your sense of
No, very much not being open about it. Yeah. But it wasn't really brought home to me until a very specific priest that I was good friends with in high school was revealed to be a rapist, and he actually spent time in prison. And that was so close to home. And this was a guy, to his credit, that my dad had never liked, but that, you know, I had always waved away his concerns. But it wasn't until it struck so close to home then that I really thought, you know, you just don't know. It could be anyone, and they're protecting these men.
Did you ever talk to your father about that? I mean, you know, have a conversation about should the church be doing this? I mean, again, this was not public. This wasn't in all the papers at this time.
My dad was in an interesting position because he was married. So he was trusted more by parishes. So I think that we tended to go to places where there had been scandals in those churches. Mm-hmm. But I had always felt growing up that he very much stood on the side of good as far as that went. You know, mm-hmm. I knew that he had stood up to particular bishops about it, that he had, like, left certain dioceses because he felt that they were not doing enough about it. So it was never something where I held him culpable. But it's also true that if you're within the institution, I mean, you are a part of it. Mm. Part of the genius of institutions is that it spreads blame so thinly across a great area that you don't know whose fault it is.
Tell us more about your husband, Jason. You do move away from the house. Tell us about meeting Jason and your decision to move away.
Oh, I met him on the frickin' internet. Now, this was back in the time that, as I say in the book, my mom believed that the internet was a country where murderers lived.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that was the idea back then, right? We mm-hmm. thought that that's just, like, where all the killers hung out. But I met him actually on a poetry bulletin board back in the late 90s to the early 1000s. And that was a really sort of unusual way to meet your spouse back in the day. You know, now everyone's on Tinder and Grindr and, like, meeting all their sex husbands that way. But it was really unusual back then. And I was 19, and I said, you know, I'm running across the country with this guy I met on the internet, which it does sound insane now that I say it that way.
Were you running away from home? I mean, what was your relationship with the family at that point?
I think I was. I mean, it wasn't just the home, but it was also the place I lived, which was it was drab. I mean, I grew
Kansas
up in
City,
sort of
Missouri,
economically.
Right?
No, this was Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, okay. Now you're in Cincinnati. Yeah.
Yes, this is where I lived across from the tank farm. But basically all these places we grew up in, we were never in the nice parts of town. It was always, like, economically depressed. People didn't really get out. You know, they sort of stayed in these parts of town and had families there and just continued the cycle. So it wasn't just my family that I was trying to get away from. It was sort of what I felt was, like, the drabness, I think, of Midwest existence. And I never did things in a normal way where, you know, a normal person might think, you know, I'll go to college on the East Coast and I'll get out that way. For me, it had to be this crazy thing where I just move across the country with a guy, you know, I meet online.
And you did, but eventually moved back. Your husband, Jason, eventually developed a rare form of cataracts.
Yes.
And that meant that you eventually did move back with your parents for a few months. What was that like?
Yes, once we became destitute enough, we did move back in with my parents. We were there actually for about 8 months. And it was really strange because all these things you took for granted in your childhood, you know, how every single conversation somehow circled around the church, you know, just the centrality of it in the home. You were forced back into that and you saw how strange it was with really fresh eyes. And you also saw it, you know, through the eyes of someone else because I was there with my husband and he would just be looking at me like, what the frick are these people talking about? Why is your dad asking me if I've read, you know, a blog post that this bishop has written? And I'm like, it's because that's all he ever talks about, you know, but you saw it as newly strange.
They see it through somebody else's eyes. So has your family read the memoir? What do they think?
Now, some of my siblings have, and they have all been extremely supportive. My dad does not read anything I write in just like a very freewheeling way. Like, don't even think it's ever going to happen. Like, there's no submarines in your book, so I'm not going to read it.
I see.
Yeah. Now, we're trying to get my mom to listen to the audiobook because I read the audiobook. And I'm like, Mom, then it's just like I'm telling you a nice story while we're on some road trip, you know, and I'm just like spinning out the story of my life. You can listen to that, right?
You'll see. You got to stay tuned for that. You are a poet, essentially, and now you've written this memoir. And in fact, you'd been called Twitter's poet laureate.
Yes.
How did you take that? I don't know how to take that.
I never considered it a serious label, but it was true that after this latest round of interviews and articles and profiles that sort of came out in the wake of the book, that some people seem to have been taking it more seriously. And one lady got really mad and sent me like hundreds and hundreds of tweets over like a several week period about how many, many other people deserve to be the poet laureate of Twitter before I did.
You can't even answer that one, can you? It's just
no, so we shouldn't call me that anymore because I like feel bad for this lady. She's like, look, I got a list. I got all these guys who should be the laureate before you.
What was it like for you switching from poetry to writing this memoir?
It was very difficult because poetry is so much shorter than a nonfiction. This book is, you know, something like 333 mm-hmm. pages or something like that. Just in the sheer length of it, it's extremely different. You know, you write a book of poetry, the entire thing can be 300 words if you space them out properly. Mm-hmm. So I was unprepared for just sort of the there's a kind of drudgery to writing that kind of prose where you sit down and it's like putting one train caboose, you know, after another, like one foot in front of another. You have to tell people what year it is. You have to tell them where you were. You have to tell them the basic facts. And that was always why I liked poetry, because you didn't have to do that stuff.
Well, you did that stuff in your memoir, Priest Daddy, and I'm talking to Patricia Lockwood, who wrote it. It is called Priest Daddy, and she's going to read Saturday evening at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. Patricia, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find out more about the book and her readings at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director, North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.